Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the August 26, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week, we have President Trump. He's sitting in a lounge chair beside a swimming pool. He is in his golfing outfit. He's got a red Trump 2024 baseball cap on. He's got kind of a concerned look on his face. Stacked all behind him on the pool deck are those cardboard filing boxes. They're labeled top secret, classified. One of them has the black and yellow nuclear symbol on it. And the headline says, "Boxed in. Will Trump be prosecuted for hiding top secret documents at Mar-a-Lago?" That is our first main story. We'll start with that. The DOJ's criminal investigation of Trump. What happened? The Department of Justice triggered new political shockwaves this week by confirming it was conducting an ongoing criminal investigation into Donald Trump's efforts to conceal highly classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago estate. In a filing to a federal court, the DOJ argued against releasing the full affidavit that led to a search warrant for the 11 sets of classified and top secret documents seized from Trump's home, saying details of what it sought would compromise future investigative steps and likely chill efforts to get witnesses to cooperate. Some of the seized documents related to nuclear weapons, according to a Washington Post report. A Trump associate said some others were connected to a federal investigation of contacts between Russia and Trump's 2016 campaign. An unsealed warrant said Trump was under investigation for possible violations of the Espionage Act, which forbids unauthorized possession of national defense secrets, as well as laws against unlawful possession or destruction of government documents. The search was the culmination of a months-long effort by the National Archive and the Justice Department to retrieve documents they believed Trump illegally removed when he left the White House. It became a criminal investigation after officials began to suspect Trump's camp was concealing documents it did not intend to turn over. In June, a Trump lawyer signed a statement asserting that all classified materials held at Mar-a-Lago had been returned when 15 boxes were carted away months earlier. But someone with inside knowledge tipped off investigators there were more. Justice Department officials found 11 additional boxes in the basement at Mar-a-Lago and obtained a subpoena to retrieve them. While Trump continued to refuse to turn them over, investigators saw on security footage that boxes were being moved in and out of that room, the New York Times reported. Trump called the investigation a politically motivated hoax by a corrupt FBI and claimed without providing any evidence that he declassified all documents in his possession before leaving office. In response to strong criticism from Republican lawmakers, Attorney General Merrick Garland confirmed he'd approved the search of Trump's home and asked for the unsealing of the search warrant so that the public could see the serious nature of what was being sought. "Upholding the rule of law means applying the law evenly without fear or favor," Garland said. What the editorial said: "Garland has put a badly divided country on a perilous political course," said the Wall Street Journal. "His unprecedented search of the residence of a former president and possible 2024 candidate breached a norm that has stood for 232 years. That's an inherently political act. If Garland doesn't find strong evidence of a crime, he will have unleashed political forces and a legal precedent that Democrats, as much as Donald Trump, may come to regret." We've become so numb to Trump's norm violations that it can be hard to see where the line is anymore, said the Miami Herald. This is different. Taking top secret national security documents from the White House and hiding them from investigators is next level stuff, even for Trump. There's much we still don't know, but this moment is a test for the rule of law. What the columnists said. The burning question, said Timothy O'Brien in Bloomberg, is why did Trump take these documents? Two troubling possibilities are impossible to ignore. One is that the deeply indebted, cash-strapped Trump saw the potential of selling state secrets to foreign governments. Another is that he was trying to bury incriminating material, possibly including communications with foreign leaders such as Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump's defenders are making laughable comparisons between what Trump did and Hillary Clinton's emails, said Philip Rotner in The Bulwark. The two cases are fundamentally different. While serving as Secretary of State, Clinton improperly sent a handful of emails containing classified information over a private email server. Trump is suspected of stealing classified and top secret information and refusing to hand it over when he was caught. By giving in to Democratic pressure to go after Trump, Garland risks plunging this nation into the abyss, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Prosecuting the likely 2024 opponent of the president he serves is a flagrant conflict of interest that will further undermine his department's legitimacy. The public interest calls for Garland to exercise forbearance and not turn this complex dispute into a criminal matter. Actually, the Fed's case looks quite strong, said former federal prosecutor Renato Mariotti in Politico. Unlike inciting an insurrection, taking and concealing classified material is a crime that is regularly charged and straightforward to prove. Trump's lawyer's false signed statement claiming everything had been returned points to a clear obstruction charge. Other federal employees who've done similar things have been let off in handcuffs and sentenced to lengthy prison terms. Our controversy of the week is political violence, the growing threats from Trump's loyalists. In Cincinnati, a gunman armed with an assault-style rifle tried to shoot his way into an FBI field office and was later killed by law enforcement. The federal judge who issued a search warrant for President Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate faced an online onslaught of anti-Semitic attacks. The names of FBI agents were outed online, and the Bureau picked up a threat to explode a radioactive dirty bomb at its Washington, D.C. headquarters. Trump supporters and even Republican politicians are calling to defund the FBI and are preparing for armed rebellion and civil war. This is what the party of Trump has wrought, said the Boston Globe editorial board. In response to the FBI's seizure of classified and top-secret documents hidden in Trump's basement, the party that once stood for law and order is willing to go to any lengths to defend this one lawless man. Trump himself is throwing gas on the fire with claims the DOJ's search was a partisan assault seen only in broken third-world countries, said former FBI agent Frank Figliuzzi in MSNBC. If Trump is eventually indicted for stealing the classified documents or some January 6-related crime, the dangerous rhetoric and violent actions of last week provide an ominous preview of what might transpire. The left acts as if it is completely innocent of political violence, said Timothy Carney in Washington Examiner. That's absurd. In recent weeks, several pro-life crisis centers have been vandalized and firebombed, and there have been death threats to Supreme Court justices, with an armed man arrested near the home of Justice Brett Kavanaugh. For the liberal media, if leftists do it, it's no big deal, even when it involves assassinating people. If conservative or religious people do it, then it's political violence. The search at Mar-a-Lago should not provoke such rage, said Bobby Gosch in Bloomberg. In many of the world's democracies, putting a former president in the dock is a signal that nobody is above the nation's laws. In France, Brazil, South Africa, Israel, South Korea, and the Philippines, former leaders have been tried and often convicted for crimes committed or covered up while in power, without violent reactions. And rather than enfeebling democracy, the high-profile demonstration of accountability strengthens its sinews. Many Americans think Trump should be above the law, but this is one area where America should not be exceptional. Whatever happens to Trump, let's not overstate the likelihood of civil war, said Bonnie Christian in the Daily Beast. Yes, intermittent spasms of political violence may become a regular feature of American life, but most Americans are simply too spoiled, soft, and comfortable to turn into full-time guerrilla warriors. What we may see is something resembling the Troubles, the low-intensity urban warfare that plagued Northern Ireland for decades. The Civil War, after all, was about something, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. Today, the U.S. faces violence from people who claim to be defending liberty and freedom, but these are merely code words for personal grudges, racial and class resentments. Trump supporters don't care if he stole secrets or tried to stage a coup. They see Trump and his crusade, their crusade, the drama that gives their lives meaning, as more important than the law. The majority of Americans and the DOJ should not be intimidated by MAGA world's threats of violence. To cave in means the end of democracy. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for identifying the enemy, after scientists in Spain began naming heat waves to encourage the public to view them as seriously as they do storms and hurricanes. Zoe, the first named heat wave, recently broiled Seville with temperatures of 112 degrees. It was a good week for accidental empires. After officials made an error that awarded a new homebuyer in Sparks, Nevada, the title to 87 additional properties, officials will ask the buyer to transfer the title back, but the buyer responded with a no comment and a smiley face emoji. It was a good week for Abby, a 13-year-old poodle hound mix that disappeared 2 months ago after she was found alive, emaciated, and very hungry inside a cave in Missouri. It's amazing how she's springing back already, said her owner, Jeff Bonert. But it was a bad week for Alec Baldwin after an FBI investigation concluded that the gun that killed cinematographer Helena Hutchins on the set of Rust last October could not have fired without a pull of the trigger. Baldwin has insisted the trigger was never pulled. It was a bad week for fines. After the retreating waters of Lake Mead in drought-stricken Nevada revealed another set of human bones, possibly a fifth body dumped in the lake decades ago. And it was a bad week for Homo sapiens, with reports from Brazil that people have been poisoning gangs of monkeys in a misguided attempt to prevent monkeypox, which is actually being spread by other primates, humans. The name chosen for this new disease is very unfortunate, said wildlife advocate Danair Giovanni. And a short and other news piece. Border arrests drop, still set annual record. Arrests along the southern border dropped in July for the second month in a row, but the U.S. is still on pace for more than 2 million border arrests this fiscal year. They have already topped last year's record of 1.66 million. Federal agents made 181,552 arrests last month, a decline of 19% from May, when the agency recorded an all-time monthly high of 224,000 apprehensions. Customs and Border Patrol Commissioner Chris Magnus attributed the dip to a focus on policing human smuggling and a messaging campaign aimed at dissuading migrants. Most of the migrants are coming from Central America, though asylum seekers arriving from countries such as Cuba and Venezuela are on the rise. The title of the briefing is The Rise of Monkeypox. Once rarely seen outside of Africa, the disease is spreading across the U.S. and around the world. What is monkeypox? First identified by Danish scientists in 1958, monkeypox is caused by a virus that's a milder cousin of smallpox. It was discovered in laboratory monkeys, but its primary vectors are thought to be rodents. The first known human case surfaced in a 9-month-old boy in Congo in 1970. Since then, most cases have been limited to West and Central Africa, where people catch it by coming into close contact with infected animals. Limited cases traceable to African animals have occurred elsewhere, including the U.S., where in 2003, about 70 cases were reported among people who got it from pet prairie dogs who'd been housed with African animals. But the current outbreak is unprecedented. Why have there been so many cases? The disease is now spreading from human to human, overwhelmingly through men having sex with other men. Since the first cases surfaced in May, the spread has been rapid. About 35,000 cases have been confirmed worldwide and 12,689 in the U.S. as of August 16th, according to the Centers for Disease Control, a 34% increase from a week earlier. Those numbers are thought to be a fraction of the true case counts. The World Health Organization declared monkeypox a global emergency on July 23rd. The U.S. designated it a national health emergency 2 weeks later. How does it affect people? Those infected typically develop a flu-like illness with symptoms including fever, head and muscle aches, fatigue, and swollen lymph nodes. That's followed by a painful rash that develops into fluid-containing pustules that scab over. Symptoms generally appear 6 to 13 days after exposure, though it can take as long as 3 weeks. Patients are infectious from when symptoms start to when the scabs fall off, sometimes leaving scars. There have been no fatalities in the U.S., and patients typically recover on their own. But the pain and discomfort can be debilitating. One study found it led to hospitalization in 10% of patients. "It was like someone taking a hole puncher all over my body," said Kevin Kwong, a California man hospitalized with over 600 lesions. Why is it spreading now? Virologists think monkeypox may have undergone small mutations that have enabled it to pass readily from person to person. It spreads primarily through intimate skin-to-skin contact and possibly through genital fluids, with 98% of cases affecting gay or bisexual men, according to a recent study. In theory, it may also spread through respiratory droplets from a cough or sneeze, or through bedding or towels shared with an infected person. But scientists are quick to note that it's not nearly as infectious as COVID, which spreads easily through the air. "What we're seeing is casual spread," said Jay Gladstein, an infectious disease specialist in Los Angeles. "It's got to be really close contact." What's been the response? Scientists say federal health officials were too slow to react when the first cases surfaced outside Africa in early May. Community spread should have rung alarm bells. said Perry Halkitis, dean of the Rutgers School of Public Health. That was when officials should have begun ramping up testing capacity and stockpiling vaccines. Instead, early testing was limited and results had to be sent to the CDC for confirmation. It wasn't until late June that the government expanded capacity by sending tests to commercial labs. The government holds a large stockpile of an effective vaccine, Jynneos, which was formulated for smallpox but was slow to release doses and to order more. While millions of doses are now on order, men in some cities are lining up for a very inadequate number of shots, and the FDA has authorized doctors to split up doses to extend them. Critics say contact tracing has been inadequate, and so has outreach to doctors who may not realize their patients have monkeypox. The critics also say public health messaging has failed to clearly warn gay and bisexual men that they are by far at the highest risk of being infected. Can it be contained? That remains to be seen, but many experts say it's too late to reverse the outbreak. Monkeypox is destined to become entrenched in the population, they believe, and while it won't spread as widely as COVID has, it may make inroads into the general population. At least 5 children and 1 pregnant woman in the U.S. have been infected through contact with infected men. One concern is that the virus could take root among domestic animals, which could spread it back to humans. Improved contact tracing, better outreach campaigns, and expanded funding of sexual health clinics can all help combat the virus. But experts say an aggressive, large-scale response is needed now. There is an imminent window of time by which we can get ahead of the spread, said Tyler Tamir of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. And that window continues to close. We'll move into the best columns of the week. We'll start with 2 from the U.S. Democrats' chances in November. The Democrats' prospects in the November midterms have shifted from bleak to blurry, said Philip Bump. 6 months ago, it looked as if the midterm elections would be a robust Republican rout, but polls show Democrats have pulled even with the GOP on a generic ballot of which party voters prefer for Congress. Statistician Nate Silver's 538.com site now gives the Democrats a 22% chance of holding the House and a 62% chance of holding the Senate. President Biden's approval ratings remain historically low, but have leveled off. What changed? Gas prices have plunged by $1 a gallon, and the Supreme Court's Dobbs ruling overturning Roe may be a factor. In 2 recent special elections, Democrats outperformed their 2020 vote share, and in Kansas, a referendum allowing abortion to be banned was defeated in a landslide. It's still 90 days out from the election, and a lot can change in 3 months. But at the moment, Democrats are in a very unusual historical position, with their party and congressional candidates significantly more popular than their president. Does that mean they could really hold the House? It may sound like a cop-out, but it's too early to say. Iran's plot to kill Bolton. The revelation that Iran offered $300,000 for the assassination of former National Security Advisor John Bolton should serve as a sobering reminder of Tehran's depravity, said Bobby Ghosh. The Justice Department last week unsealed charges against Shahram Porsafi, a member of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, for allegedly putting out the reward for a hit on Bolton, and a second reward for killing former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The plan to kill 2 former top federal officials on U.S. soil was likely meant as retaliation for the 2020 drone strike that took out Qasem Soleimani, a top IRGC commander the U.S. had designated as a terrorist. Tehran has dramatically escalated its international assassination campaign with plots against Israelis and the arrest last month of a man armed with an AK-47 outside the Brooklyn home of Masih Alinejad, a critic of the regime. This all comes as the Biden administration struggles to persuade Iran to revive the nuclear deal it signed in 2015. Can Biden really trust Iran to comply with the terms of the deal and not pursue a nuclear weapon? The obvious question is whether a regime this reckless can be trusted with any deal at all. This column comes from Belgium. The Hunger Stones of the 21st Century. Could Europe turn into a desert? Asked Pascal Martin. The prospect was once thought to be a disaster scenario, but it's happening right now. We're in the thick of what could be the worst drought in 500 years. The lack of rain is harming tourism and drying up the source of the Moselle River, which is critically important to farmlands of France and Germany. The drought has even uncovered hunger stones in some Czech and German rivers, used to mark the low water levels that preceded famines. One stone recently revealed along the Elbe dates from 1616 and reads, "If you see me, cry." Experts believe Europe's fertile lands are gradually being dried up permanently from south to north and becoming poorer from year to year. The European Union wants to neutralize this degradation over the next decade by promoting healthy soils that will retain water, but it is still letting farmers grow water-intensive crops that deplete soils and make them more vulnerable to drought. Yes, we have more advanced irrigation systems now than we did in the days of the Hunger Stones, but even those are being imperiled. Spain's intricate system of reservoirs and dams was once the model to follow, but now its water reserves are drying up. The water wars are not inevitable, but we're running out of time to avert a very real threat. The Last Word, our feature article. When the neighbors drive you out. Local code enforcement is harsh and arbitrary, said Radley Balco in the Nashville Scene. And in Nashville, gentrifiers routinely harness it to harass homeowners they don't like. Freddie Benford and his wife, Clarice Ramey, bought their home, a modest white brick ranch home in East Nashville's Rosebank neighborhood, in 1997. It's a pretty plot of land with a sun-drenched, gently sloped front yard and a backyard lined with trees. The house itself looks well lived in. There's some peeling paint and a rusty, photogenic pair of old lawn chairs out front. It's certainly not an eyesore. The grass is well trimmed. There's no visible trash. No furniture on the lawn, no debris. From the street or even the front yard, you'd be hard-pressed to understand why, according to Benford, inspectors from the Metro Codes Department have visited the couple more than 50 times, or why, he says, they've racked up $3,500 in fines, or why in 2016, just a few years after the couple finally paid off their mortgage, the city put a lien on their home, one that remains in place today. According to the city, the first problem is the small fishing boat the couple has parked on a trailer in their front yard. That apparently isn't allowed. Neither are the cars sometimes parked off the driveway, slightly on the lawn. But to get to the main problem, I have to take the couple's long driveway to go up to the house and enter the backyard to find the carport that extends out from the home. Benford spends a lot of time under the carport. He works on his own faded blue 1967 Dodge Coronet here and fixes up other cars. I've been a mechanic for 40 years, he says. Benford tinkers at his workbench and listens to the radio. On the blistering June day I visit, it isn't hard to see why he likes it. The trees provide shade, rustle up a nice breeze, and bathe the area in dappled light. As we talk, the couple's lab mix, Bella, patrols a T-shaped patch of grass. See that mini fridge over there? He wrote me up for that, Benford says, referring to the codes inspector. I never heard of something so dumb. A man can't have a mini fridge in his own garage. Benford sighs, rolls his eyes, and continues. He wrote me up for having tools out here. Said you can't have tools that aren't put away. He said I can't have the workbench. Once I was drinking a can of soda when he came over. He told me to put it away. You believe that? I'm a grown man and you're telling me to put away my soda? Everything you see out here, they told me I can't have. Benford's coronet itself is also an issue. Nashville prohibits residents from keeping inoperable or unregistered vehicles on residential properties unless they're stored in an enclosed garage. Paradoxically, the city also forbids residents from making major repairs on their own vehicles, again, unless it's done in an enclosed garage. For Benford, that means the coronet has broken down over the years. His only legal option is to have it towed to a garage and pay someone else to fix it, even though he has the skills to fix it himself. According to Benford, the same codes inspector has repeatedly shown up at his house over the years solely to demand that Benford prove that the car is operable. I lost count of how many times he made me do that, Benford said. More than 20. It's just outrageous and demeaning, says Jamie Holland, the couple's attorney. You're going to come out and make this man start his car for you on command? You're going to put a lien on this couple's home over an old car, some chairs and a carport, a GD refrigerator? Over the past 3 years, Nashville's Metro Codes Department has fielded more than 95,000 complaints. Some complaints concern unkempt vacant lots, abandoned buildings that pose a fire hazard, dumped garbage, or cars abandoned in alleyways. Others are requests for the city to remove old signs or debris. But browse the content of complaints themselves. They're all conveniently posted and plotted on the city's NashView site, and you'll see a lot of complaints from residents about eyesores, tall grass, unregistered vehicles, cars parked on grass, or houses in need of new paint or siding. You'll see a lot of neighbors reporting neighbors. Think about who a system like this targets and who it benefits, said Joanna Weiss, co-director of the Fines and Fees Justice Center in New York. Poor people don't typically call codes on their neighbors because poor people don't trust the legal system. The people who benefit from complaint-driven systems are people for whom the legal system already works perfectly. Wealthy people, white people, developers, and they usually use it as a weapon against people who don't have the means to fight back. Codes inspectors often tell people they cite that they're only enforcing the law, that they aren't given the discretion to overlook even petty violations. That isn't quite true. There's no provision that prohibits Freddie Benford's mini fridge, for example, or his soda can, or the tools he keeps under his carport. But there is a prohibition on open storage, and that gives inspectors wide discretion to cite anything in a yard they or a neighbor might find unsightly. They told me I was in violation of open storage because I had more cushions on my porch than I had chairs, said Claire, an East Nashville resident who asked to not be identified by her real name. Several sources for this article said they feared retaliation from the city or codes and requested anonymity. I had a shovel leaning against my house. He ordered me to put that away. My husband had cut some 2x4s into blocks for my kids to play with. The inspector called it construction debris. Because one neighbor complained about our yard, It was like he was looking for as many violations as he could. I had a tenant, a couple, who loved garden gnomes, said Bert, a builder and landlord whose properties include affordable housing. They had dozens of them. The neighbors hated the gnomes and called codes. But I told the city that this is art. You may hate it, you may think it's ugly, but it's art, and there's no code prohibiting it. They backed off the gnomes, but then started citing them for all sorts of ticky-tack violations until they had to move. The vagueness of the rules is one of two fundamental problems with Nashville's codes enforcement. The other is that it is primarily driven by anonymous complaints. Anyone can call in a complaint to the 311 hotline or send one through the city's website. I'd compare it to anti-loitering laws, said Weiss. You have these vague laws that are wildly open to interpretation that essentially make everyone a potential criminal. But then you have this added component where everyday people become the enforcers with no accountability for false reporting. The Tennessee legislature established countywide environmental courts in 1991. The initial legislation authorized counties of more than 600,000 people, essentially Davidson County, in which includes Nashville, and Shelby, which includes Memphis, to set up a special docket under General Sessions courts solely to hear codes complaints. By 2001, the number of Nashville codes cases had grown to the point that the General Sessions judge, who oversaw them, couldn't keep up. She created a new position, a referee, to take over the docket. The referee is not a judge, and the environmental court itself is more administrative than legal. The ambiguousness of it all gave city officials what they wanted, the ability to plow through stacks of cases relatively quickly. The priority in the environmental court is efficiency, not due process, said Bill Maurer, a litigator with the Institute for Justice, a libertarian public interest law firm. They don't adhere to the rules of evidence. They don't pay much attention to rights. The goal is to resolve as many cases as possible, as quickly as possible. That's a big problem because you're dealing with people's most important and cherished possession, their home. Maurer and the Institute for Justice currently represent two Memphis residents who lost their homes because of environmental court decisions. In both cases, the residents couldn't afford to make repairs after a storm damaged their homes. The city bulldozed one house. It evicted the other client, an elderly woman, and put her possessions on the street. It then auctioned off her home. Both people are now homeless. The environmental courts don't record their hearings, Maurer says. They don't preserve evidence. So sure, you can appeal a decision, but you can only appeal based on what's in the record. And for most of these cases, there is no record. It's just a series of orders. The current Davidson County referee, Renard Hirsch, is a commercial and bankruptcy lawyer who was appointed in 2017 and hears cases one or two days per week. Hirsch's approach to the position has been especially irksome to Holland. The previous referees at least understood that these are administrative hearings, he says. They wore business attire. Hirsch came in on the first day wearing a robe and hoisting a gavel. Holland adopts a scolding tone. You are not a judge. You do not preside over a real court. You are a part-time administrator who helps the city harass poor people for parking on their own grass. Browse Facebook groups for Nashville's neighborhoods, and you'll also see speculation that builders and developers have weaponized code departments to target low-income holdouts in rapidly gentrifying neighborhoods. They call in a series of complaints, the theory goes, then swoop in with a lowball offer. Because complaints are anonymous, it's almost impossible to prove who filed them. But in 2019, Nashville's Fox affiliate, WZTV, ran a series of reports alleging that developers were weaponizing codes to target properties they wanted to acquire. Two reports focused on Evelyn Suggs, a beloved then 94-year-old black landlord in North Nashville. Suggs told the station several of her properties had recently been hit with a rash of codes complaints. Shortly after, developers began contacting her with offers to buy those properties. Some made reference to her battles with codes. Other local residents, including Freddie Benford, have similar stories. It's possible that these developers simply scoured the complaints and court records available online to find property owners with fines, then made offers to those owners. But Bert, the local builder, says he's witnessed it firsthand. "It absolutely happens," he says. "I go so far as to say it's common. I personally heard developers boast about lighting up codes on a property they want to buy." Advocates like Weiss and Maurer say abuses such as this are frequent in other places. "It's just eminent domain by another name," Maurer says. "Instead of officially declaring a property blighted or handing it over to a developer, you just hit it with codes complaints until the owner is overwhelmed." Feeling outcast is a common sentiment among codes targets. That includes my wife and me, after a neighbor called codes on us, complaining about weeds in our sloped backyard. Fixing this cost us $4,000 and has caused new problems with soil erosion. You feel a bit like a pariah, like you're a scourge on the neighborhood. It changes how you feel about your neighbors, your place in the community, your relationship with the city. On some level, the codes issue is just another debate about who Nashville is for, about who gets to have a stake in how the city grows and evolves. I moved to Nashville in 2010, fell in love with the city, and persuaded my now wife to move from New York in 2015. We've wrestled with our own contribution to the neighborhood's gentrification, but while we've had problems with neighbors over the years, we've never considered reporting someone to the city. The problem with anonymous complaint-driven codes enforcement is that it puts the shape and direction of the city in the hands of people who do. "It's a sham, a joke," Holland says of the Davidson County Environmental Court, a predatory body. Recalling his first visit there, Holland summarizes the reality of how codes enforcement operates. "Here's the common denominator among the people I saw in that room: poor, black, and elderly. 95% of them didn't have a lawyer, and their rights were being trampled." This was adapted from Code Snitching, originally published in the Nashville Scene. Here's a technology article. Legislation supercharging green tech. "Get ready for a gold rush in climate technology," said Alan Neuhauser in Axios. Thanks to $369 billion in tax credits and other funding in the wide-ranging Inflation Reduction Act, long-suffering startups devoted to sustainability and energy technologies suddenly look much more attractive to investors. Venture capitalists have often said they prefer businesses that don't rely on government subsidies, said John Gerster, a partner at Growth Stage Investment from Activate Capital. But the scale of this package is stunning. "The federal aid also comes with a long-term commitment," said Adele Peters in Fast Company. In the past, short-term government incentives for renewable energy repeatedly faced expiration, creating risk for ventures that relied on them. This time, the tax credits will last a decade, giving investors the certainty to pour more capital into startups. "Climate tech is luring young workers away from big tech," said Michelle Ma in Protocol. the Facebook of yore pioneered social media. But for engineers today, climate tech is the most exciting space in tech right now. A growing talent pool of Gen Z workers is drawn to climate tech because they can be excited and proud of their work. The same can't always be said of big tech, where dream jobs at companies like Facebook have turned into nightmares. Some initiatives the Act will support sound like they were stolen from science fiction movies, said Pransal Verma and Evan Halper in the Washington Post. For instance, there is a tax credit for geothermal technologies that convert heat generated from Earth's core into clean power sources. Another area that will get funding, green hydrogen, a zero-emissions fuel produced using wind and solar power, and a high-tech electrolysis process that has been hampered by high costs. Veterans of the clean energy industry might have feelings of deja vu, said Mark Bergen in Bloomberg. 15 years ago, venture capitalists started special funds to invest in the sector, only to disappear when markets soured. Rising interest rates have already diminished investors' risk appetite in 2022. But there are reasons for optimism that history isn't exactly repeating. During the first wave, solar power, wind energy, and electric cars were too costly and unproven. All those technologies have developed and advanced, while gas price sticker shock and the war in Ukraine have added urgency to the search for new energy sources. Big asset managers and corporations are also backing solutions to climate change. Whether that's because of shareholder pressure or out of moral compunction, hardly matters. On the health and science page, we have hope for preventing Lyme disease. Good news for anyone who spends time outdoors, reports NBCNews.com. Drug makers are entering the final stages of creating a vaccine for Lyme disease. There is currently no federally approved inoculation for the tick-borne virus, which can cause fever, headaches, fatigue, muscle aches, and if left untreated, serious long-term effects. An estimated 476,000 Americans are diagnosed with the disease every year. The new vaccine, which was developed by Pfizer and French drug maker Valneva, is about to begin late-stage clinical trials. About 6,000 healthy adults and children will be enrolled in the U.S. and five European countries where the disease is also endemic. Earlier trials showed that the shot, called VLA-15, triggered an immune response with no adverse reactions reported. If all goes well, Pfizer hopes to submit the vaccine for Food and Drug Administration approval in 2025. Development of a jab for Lyme has taken on a growing urgency in recent years as diagnoses of the disease have risen sharply by an estimated 357% in rural areas between 2007 and 2021, and by 65% in urban areas. The main reason is climate change. Warmer temperatures are enabling the black-legged ticks that carry the virus to thrive in regions previously too chilly for them. With increasing global rates of Lyme disease, said Annalise Anderson from Pfizer, providing a new option for people to help protect themselves is more important than ever. The Cartwheel Galaxy. The James Webb Space Telescope has produced its latest wonder, a stunning image of the Cartwheel Galaxy, some 500 million light years from Earth. Wagon wheel-like in appearance, the Cartwheel formed in a coalition of two galaxies hundreds of millions of years ago. Unusually, the smaller of the two galaxies didn't get stuck in the larger one. Instead, it shot through the middle like a bullet. What changed the Cartwheel shape, said Marcia Rieke, an astronomer on the Webb team, was the influence of this other galaxy's gravitational field. That changed the orbits of stars in the original galaxy to create its distinctive two bright rings and wavy spokes. This isn't the first time scientists have seen the Cartwheel, reports the New York Times. Images produced by the Hubble telescope in the 1990s sparked widespread interest in the galaxy. But the Webb's image is much more detailed, showing the formation of new stars within the galaxy's rings and the presence of other star systems beyond. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. COVID. Is the CDC giving up? The pandemic is over, said Zachary Faria in the Washington Examiner, and it's time for government officials to catch up. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control released updated COVID guidelines that essentially concede it is time to go back to normal. The CDC dropped recommendations that people stay 6 feet apart and that individuals quarantine if they are just exposed to someone with COVID. But the agency still recommends that people in areas with high community transmission wear a mask indoors. The previous guidelines had been obsolete for more than a year now, and as the agency itself noted, COVID is here to stay. With vaccines and effective treatments now available, there is no need for the government to continue to dictate how people, especially children, live their lives. Eliminating blanket restrictions makes sense, especially for schools, said Leanna Nguyen in the Washington Post. But the pandemic is not over. The highly infectious BA5 subvariant will continue to cause many outbreaks, and everyone engaging in public life should be aware that those around them could be infected. Vaccination and previous infections have armed most people's immune systems against severe illness and death. And kids rarely get seriously ill. People who remain vulnerable may need to wear high-quality masks when they go out in public. At this point in the pandemic, the emphasis must shift from universal mandates to individual decisions. Let's be honest about what the individual risk strategy means, said Eric Topol in The Guardian. Despite the rose-colored glasses through which the CDC and most Americans prefer to see the pandemic, 94% of counties in the U.S. have high transmission, with more than 40,000 people hospitalized and nearly 500 deaths per day. Only 32% of eligible Americans have gotten a booster shot, despite the significant protection against a severe illness they are proven to provide. If Americans use the tools available, including masks for indoor activities and booster shots, we could contain the virus once and for all. Instead, the CDC is telling us we should just learn to live with repeated infections. The agency has been giving incoherent, outdated advice since 2020, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. The CDC has been consistently behind evolving scientific knowledge, behind the curve of COVID's evolution, behind how most Americans have already adapted. Its credibility is shot. And we'll go into some of the shorter notes. Enforcement funding for the Internal Revenue Service has dropped by 31% since 2010, when Republicans gained control of Congress and made severe budget cuts in the agency. The audit rate for Americans making more than $1 million a year dropped from 8.4% that year to 2.4% in 2019. Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who this month single-handedly blocked Democrats from closing the tax loophole that benefits private equity and hedge fund managers, has received nearly $1 million over the past year from such financial professionals. One private equity manager made the maximum $5,800 contribution in late June, as did his three college-age children. Since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June, Democrats have spent nearly $32 million on ads about abortion. nearly 8 times the amount Republicans have spent on abortion-themed ads. In some of the most closely contested Senate and gubernatorial races, Republicans have devoted no money to ads on the abortion issue. Among white adults, 38% report receiving gifts or loans worth at least $10,000 from parents or relatives, an NPR Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Harvard poll revealed. Among black households, 14% were given such sums of money. On the poll watch, 71% of Americans believe climate change is occurring, and 64% are extremely or very concerned how it will affect future generations. But only 52% believe their own actions can affect climate change. Among Americans who've gone on vacation in the past 3 months, over 70% say they took no precautions to reduce the risk of getting COVID, such as wearing masks. And we will finish out the show today with a quote from Warren Buffett, quoted in the Montreal Gazette, who says, "Someone is sitting in the shade today because someone planted a tree a long time ago." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.